Thank you for the introduction, and in particular, thank you for the invitation. And it goes without saying, again, that I'm very happy to be here. And so today what I'm going to talk about is a paper that I wrote with a student at UMass, Mohamed Amber, like 6 months ago, more or less. It's a paper about generation of cosmological magnetic fields in classes of inflationary models, in particular the ones driven by PNGBs, and I will discuss in detail what are PNGBs, and in particular in a specific case, that is the case of a specific inflationary model called Enflation, that is a model of inflation in string theory. So, the plan of the talk is the following. So we'll spend a few minutes about broad introductions that are in any case due, talking about how successful is inflation and how important it is to have a realization of inflation and what it can tell us about quantum field theory and what it can tell us about string theory. Are somebody there also? So, and then I will do some discussion of PNGBs. I visited Davis last time, more than 1 year ago. Some of the things that I will say here are similar to things that I said 1 year ago, but I decided in any case to repeat those things. I hope people either will have forgotten or there will be new people. But I would like to take the whole thing self-contained. And then I will very quickly introduce cosmological magnetic fields and go to, what is the main part of the talk, that will be actually only the last half of the talk, more or less, that is try to convince you that it's a kind of general prediction of inflation driven by PNGBs to produce cosmological magnetic fields. Not only, these magnetic fields are usually interesting ones, and they can evolve into the magnetic fields that we observe. So, let me start. As I said, this is something that I have to do, even if I think that's how every talk in cosmology now have to start, with talking about the success of inflation. We have, since the early 90s, we had several experiments that have consistently always supported prediction of inflation, and in particular by now we can say that it's all predictions that are supported at a few percent level, 1%, 2%, 3% level. The two strongest fact that we get out of this is that the universe appears to be spatially flat, and that there is a quasi-scale invariant spectrum of primordial perturbations. And I wanted to point out the presence of these two things at the same level, because I had the impression that, for some obvious reason, in this case, this is just the prediction given by inflation for a number, that is the curvature of the universe. In this case, we have a whole function that is predicted by inflation, and people are very much impressed by this result. And the fact that, for instance, this result, and again, I couldn't resist from putting this picture on the talk, this quasi-scale invariant spectrum of primordial perturbations leads to this very nice structure of peaks that are observed in experiments. However, I want also to point out that this is also a very nice prediction of inflation, and it's something that sometimes is a little bit overlooked. If you look at possible proposals for alternative to inflationary models, usually people start focusing immediately on the scale invariant perturbation, and they don't care too much about actually explaining the spatially flat universe. And it's funny, because this seems to be much easier to produce than this one, but people just seem not to care about it. And actually, the alternative to inflation that are proposed generally fail to realize this thing. There's doubt also about this part, but in this part, people don't even try to convince that this result is obtained. In any case, bottom line is that all the experiment observations in the last 15 years are in excellent agreement with the prediction of inflation. That was just my general introduction. Okay, so we can say, most probably, or very probably, inflation occurred. But what are the properties of inflation? Well, the first question one can ask is, of course, particularly when you do cosmology, is when. Something happened, but when? And when you do cosmology, time is equivalent to temperatures or scales of energies or Hubble parameter. And so the question is, at what energies did inflation take place? And, well, we have an upper bound on the energy scale of inflation. It comes from CMB. We observe the fluctuations in the temperature of CMB. The amplitude is 10 to minus 5, more or less, and is related to the inflationary parameters by this relation, where this is the energy density during inflation, Planck mass is Planck mass. And epsilon is the slow roll parameter that has to be smaller than 1, actually smaller than 2/3 during inflation. If you put these conditions and they require epsilon smaller than 1 or so, you get the energy density during inflation has to be smaller than about 10 to 16 GeV. This is also roughly consistent with the bounds that you get from the fact that you don't observe tensor modes in the CMB that will be generated during inflation. Okay, so this puts an upper bound on the energy at inflation. And what's the lower bound? Well, in principle, there's no lower bound. It could be as low as TeV scale. You don't want to go below TeV because in any case, after inflation, you want to have baryogenesis, nucleosynthesis to happen at 1 MeV. So you need to leave some space for things to happen. But however, unless you do a very strong fine-tuning, you don't expect this parameter epsilon to be extremely small. You expect it to be in the order of 1%. And if epsilon is not very small, you look back again at this formula, and you find that rho cannot be very small either. And so you can expect that the energy density during inflation is of the order of 10 to 15 GeV or so. That is more or less a factor of 1,000 smaller than the gravity scale.
So there's models that... So I don't understand the statement. I mean, there's these shapes of potentials you break down that lead to very inflation having a very low scale.
Sure.
Right, and I don't see the additional fine-tuning beyond getting the perturbation amplitude right.
Well, usually you need to have, however, that the potential stays very flat, and in order for that to happen, usually you have to have some very small numbers in the model. Dimensionful quantities that are small in units of Planck scale, that are very, very small in units of Planck scale.
So Kalman-Weinberg potential, adjust the energy scale, it just has to do with, that's one parameter to adjust, and then,
yeah.
And there's only one thing that you tune that's small.
Sure. But you have to have a first dimensionless quantity to be small in the first place.
So you always have that.
Well,
lambda 5 to the 4th, lambda has to be small.
Right? Yeah. Well, okay. If you want to have a TV scale inflation, usually your parameter has to be dimensionless parameters have to be of the order of 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 30.
Okay.
Then of course, that is
it's
a matter
really
of choice.
In this statement, it'd be, people who want to chase the tensor mode in the CMB, you
mm-hmm.
love this kind of statement, right?
Yeah.
But I just see, all these models in the literature and tons of them that are below 10 to 15 GeV,
Yes. That's correct.
Not even because they tried to get to low energy.
Well, they have to, because they have to be consistent with the delta T over T. I mean, there is a first fine tuning that you have in any case to put in because
that's
you
right.
have to have a small
that's
delta T over T.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, if on the top of this you want also to have a very low energy inflation, in many cases, this fine tuning has to be even stronger. That's what I would say. But it's true that in some cases,
it doesn't stop people from writing papers about it.
But
yeah.
I'm saying people write papers about it, trying to do other things, and it just ends up being low.
Oh yeah. So, I mean, to go to to my point,
okay.
I agree with you. I'll tell you why. I agree with you to the extent that these models usually don't predict an inflationary scale of the order of a TeV. If instead of being 10 to 15, it is 10 to 12.
Yeah, that's all.
I don't think, without any crazy fine-tuning, usually you don't go below that scale. In any case. But I agree on the fact that, this 1,000 could be a 10,000, a million.
Okay.
It couldn't be a factor of
you got
10 to 20.
Okay.
But I agree with you, absolutely.
Okay, so it's actually not a very interesting statement as far as detectable tensor modes goes.
No, actually, until this morning, I had another slide here in which I was trying to argue in favor of a large epsilon using the argument that, well, if one believes the evidence of a spectral index different from one, that could be an argument in favor of large epsilon. And I took it away because you can have, for instance, a very small epsilon and a very large eta.
Right, right.
And there are models of inflation at the TeV scale in which the epsilon is 10 to minus 30. You have fine tunings of the order of 10 to minus 20, but still you get a spectral index that is significantly different from 1. I mean, significantly it's 0.94 or stuff like that. So that's kind of... Let's say this 1,000 is early universe cosmologists 1,000.
Okay.
That would be easily 100,000.
Okay.
All this argument is mostly in favor of a motivation that's seen by many people to a good reason to study inflation, because in any case it probes very high energy scales, probably the highest energy scales we can hope to probe, and possibly the fundamental theory, the scale of fundamental theory of gravity, in particular if this case is realized. And if one believes that the fundamental theory of gravity is somehow related to strings, this is a place where one can have some hope to probe string theory in some way. So that's the reason why, well, since long, but in particular in the last 5+ years, people have been looking for models of inflation in string theory. And this turns out to be something that is very difficult to realize for two reasons. Well, the main argument is that in any case, at low energies, string theory has to reduce to just quantum field theory. And even if people have been looking for inflation in string theory in the last 10 years, people have been looking for inflation in quantum field theory in the last 25 years. And even just sticking to the rules of quantum field theory, people have a hard time finding models that can work. And now, in general, models of field theory that can come from, I mean, not field theory, not all of field theory models can come from string theory. So looking for models of inflation in string theory is even more difficult.
Do we know that statement is true?
I will present a potential example that supports the statement.
You just probably want to say, from known corners of string theory, given that it is such a fluid sort of...
No, absolutely.
It could produce anything it wanted nowadays.
Well, they say not quite. But, you know, that again may be a function of time, okay? So.
Let's say, half of this talk is based on the assumption that what I'm saying is true. In this,
that would actually be interesting.
Sorry? Well, one never knows. But there are two arguments of interest in string theory in this respect. One typical criticism to string theory is that it's not falsifiable. This is why string theorists now care about inflation. Second argument against string theory is that usually string theory can predict everything. And I will try to use some arguments by people that claim that actually this is not true.
Is that a good model? Is it a classical model?
It's good. By good, I mean good according to the rules of quantum field theory.
Oh.
Okay. So let me start exactly by the point of quantum field theory. In the simplest model, inflation is driven by a scalar or several scalars, I will just call it phi, with some potential. And again, just from the constraints on the running of the spectral index, we know by now that the potential V of phi has to satisfy this condition, at least at the time in which the inflaton was crossing some point that corresponds to the value of the inflaton at the point that the currently observed the scale exited the horizon. And we have these two parameters, plural parameters, epsilon and eta, that measure basically the first and the second derivative of the potential at that point, and they have to be small. or in other words, this potential V of phi has to be flat. And the typical problem, and this has been known forever, is that in particular when you work with scalar fields, and this is what you have during inflation, quantum effects trying to bring couplings to have values of order 1 in units of the cutoff of the theory. And since, well, if you want to accept the assumption that the cutoff of the theory is Planck mass, and in any case we are so close to Planck mass that it's strange to expect that there is some intermediate cutoff between the two, then one expects couplings, these couplings to be of the order 1 in units of Planck mass. This implies that automatically the parameter eta and epsilon b become of the order of the unity, that is factor of 100, larger than the order of 10 to minus 2. And so this spoils the flatness of V of phi. Okay, so what do we do? Well, again, the idea is just to go and copy what people do in the standard model and look for symmetries. In the standard model in particular, well, one possible symmetry is supersymmetry. In standard model, supersymmetry probes to work quite well in protecting the Higgs mass against big radiative correction. So the idea is, okay, why don't you use supersymmetry also for inflation? And actually, as long as you use supersymmetry alone also for inflation, it works very well. The problem is that supersymmetry is the limit of supergravity when Planck mass goes to infinity. During inflation, you cannot send, no matter how small is your inflationary scale, you cannot send the Planck mass to infinity, because this freezes cosmological expansion. So it's not just a matter of saying, well, if I have a theory that works at the TEV, I don't care about Planck mass, I just keep my global supersymmetry theory, and it is flat. And for instance, it is radiatively stable. No, in any case, when you do cosmology, you have to keep Planck mass to be fixed. And in particular, it is well known that in general, supergravity corrections, unless there are some specific symmetries I will discuss in 1 second, generate mass squared of the order of the potential divided by Planck mass squared, and this corresponds exactly to have a parameter eta of the order of the unity. And this is the well-known eta problem that has been studied again from the beginning of the 90s, more or less. So now, the other proposal is actually surprisingly much simpler than invoke the complicated machinery of supersymmetry, and is to assume that the field, the inflaton, is a shift symmetry. So a field phi is said to have a shift symmetry if its theory is invariant under phi goes to phi plus a constant. And in the regime in which this symmetry is exact, the only possible potential for phi is V of phi equal to constant. That is just a cosmological constant. It's fantastic for driving inflation. The problem is that you cannot end inflation because, of course, you just stay on a constant potential. So one has to break this symmetry. And when we break the shift symmetry, a potential for phi is generated. And I will argue in 1 second that one generically expects this potential to have this form. So to be of the form of a cosine of phi divided by f. There are two parameters in this case that are relevant for the potential. Mu, that is the height of the potential. Phi, that basically, f, that basically gives the scale of variation of the inflaton. In the limit in which f goes to infinity, the symmetry is restored. That is, v goes again to a constant. And so if you want to have a flat potential, in general, you will have to expect that f is very large, because this extends the potential in this direction. So how do we get this potential? Well, a very simple way of seeing how the cosine potential emerges is to start with a simple theory with a spontaneously broken global U1. So you have some field H with some potential of this form, usual Mexican head potential, and then one can decompose the potential into a radial, the field, sorry, around the minimum into a radial direction that is massive. It decouples, we throw it away, I forget about it, and some phase. So this phase phi corresponds to the Goldstone boson of the theory, so it's massless. Now, suppose that this global U1 symmetry is broken by, for instance, gravitational interactions. That is, incidentally, what we expect in general to happen. Gravity doesn't respect the global symmetry. the since it is broken by gravitational interactions in the limit in which Planck mass goes to infinity, additional operators that break this symmetry have to go to zero. So the first operator I can write down that breaks this symmetry and goes to zero when Planck mass goes to infinity is a dimension 5 operator. 1 over Planck mass, it has to be real, so real part of h to the power 5. And then, well, I didn't write it down, but one has also to consider 1 over Planck mass squared, h plus h stars, 6th, etc., etc., etc. At this point, a potential for this field phi is generated, and it's on the form of a cosine. So you interpret at that point v basically as your f, and v to the 5th over Planck mass as your mu to the 5th, the height of the potential. There are, of course, other ways these potentials are generated, but typically this is always the kind of way the potential emerges.
Is this also reasonable in string theory, that you should get corrections like 1 over m?
Yes. Not necessarily scales. In this form, but it's that kind of thing.
But there aren't other scales in string theory, like the string constant, or I don't know.
I'm setting all these things to 1. So you have, I'm assuming that basically Planck scale is equal to string scale, and string coupling is order 1. Of course, you can have hierarchies.
Yeah.
Oh, because, well, by dimensions, this thing has to have dimension of mass to the 4th, because it's a Lagrangian density. Because, and it has to have something that disappears when Planck mass goes to infinity. So this is the first term, and in principle you have higher harmonics, okay? And this is what is called a pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson, or PNGB. That's the simplest case you potentially generated for this thing.
How do you know this disappears when Planck mass goes to infinity? Because if you set all the string scales to be the same, then this is presumably a boson on the gravitational sector, right? And so that is also going to go to infinity with the Planck mass.
There you unfreeze the coupling.
That's
you remember
different
M1
limits.
And M string are, you know, related by a power of the Dilaton web. So we play that game. The point. Presumably, you argue there exists a limit where it happens. It is certainly not the only limit you can imagine.
Okay, well, I used this example for illustrative purposes. The more detailed example in which these things happen is actually some instanton contribution to the action, in which you have a real part of the instanton that is associated to the string coupling, and the imaginary part that is associated to the axiom. And so you have contributions that go basically as e to the something like e to the I n, the Dilaton in units of Planck mass plus the axiom in units of Planck mass with some imaginary part. So imaginary part is here, something like that. And I will get there in 1 second. But the main this is in units actually of f. And I will go to this. This can be written more or less in these terms. Just instead of having 1 over Planck mass, you have actually something like e to the minus f over Planck mass. But it's basically the same kind of argument. Okay, in any case, the main point of this discussion, and I'm already getting late, the main point of this discussion is that this is a simple case in which a potential is generated by breaking a symmetry, and so this corresponds exactly to what we want to have in quantum field theory when we want to have something that is controlled, and something that allows us to control radiative corrections. In other terms, since we break the symmetry by a certain amount, all the radiative corrections have to respect the symmetry up to that amount. So all radiative corrections cannot change significantly the shape of this potential. And in particular, if the height of this cosine potential is low, also radiative corrections will keep it low. And so this is a very good candidate for inflation in quantum field theory, and it has been known since the early 90s as a model of natural inflation. Now, let's go to the point of string theory. Well, on one side, string theory contains a lot of axioms or, well, pseudoscalars. This is actually an important thing that I forgot to say, and I will go back. Since this field comes from a phase, it's actually a pseudoscalar, and this will become very important in what I'm going to say in 1 second. In any case, string theory contains a lot of these things, so it's a good thing, because we can have a lot of these fields that can allow us to do inflation. The problem is that not every PNGB can be produced from string theory, and this is what is advertised as the swampland, as opposed to the landscape. So it's the region of field theories that cannot or appear not to come from any consistent string theory. And in particular, one of these regions of the swampland corresponds exactly to the region in which F is larger than Planck mass. String theory appears to require F smaller than a Planck mass. There's no theorem. I think there is no counterexample known, and there is people that have been looking for it hardly and didn't find anything. It's very simple argument, naive. I mean, one can go in particular through this paper, Banks, Dying, Fox, and Gorbatov, in which they tried all possibilities and they didn't find anything working. But the simple argument is the following. Let me go back again to this example. I said that F corresponds basically to V and the scale, and you have higher order terms here that appear also. 1 over Planck mass squared, H plus H star, 6th, etc. If F is larger than the Planck mass, then the expansion term becomes larger than 1. So the higher harmonics dominate. And of course, you cannot control the summation anymore, and you don't know what happens. Probably something nice can happen again, but it doesn't appear to be the case in a simple analysis.
I mean, all you're really saying is you can't get a quantum field theory limit out,
yeah,
unless you have
absolutely.
In the end, get it out with confidence, right? It doesn't mean that. Is this evidence that you don't expect ever
Is
it just hard to control?
Let's say, as far as I know, if you want to control it, you would like to have some new symmetry, and as far as I know, nobody has ever found any such symmetry.
So does this mean people really suspect this is just not a real quantum field theory?
Actually, follow up also on that question. I have that similar related question to this. You know, after all, in Fourier analysis, you do have, you know, positive and negative interference, right? I mean, constructive and destructive interference. So generally speaking, when they say that the higher harmonics are a problem, they always sort of assume the, you know, constructive interference. But what if actually they happen to flatten the potential out in special places?
I agree absolutely. And if you want, it's the same thing. You know, some time back I gave similar talk, and I've just shown the cosine potential. And, you know, people said, how comes exactly cosine potential comes out and is relatively stable? Usually it's phi squared plus phi fourth, but there is a phi sixth here that is a typical non-renormalizable. So the cosine potential emerges because there is some underlying symmetry that you don't see just like this, but you can see it if you do this derivation. So it's possible that there is something similar happening then at this level with the higher harmonics. But I'm not aware of anybody who did this thing. But it's perfectly fair to assume.
So we'll make a slightly different question. Are there people out there who once they see the perturbation getting out of control, the expansion getting out of control, and then Planck to the minus or whatever, do they say, gee, that's probably not going to be a quantum field theory at all? Is that a... At least are there some people who think that?
Sometimes they can find a duo and then the duo theory smaller than counting. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how strongly I should.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, according to those guys, they tried harder in string theory. And again, I mean, their argument in this case was the same one. They were saying, if you consider a string theory compactification that is isotropic, all moduli are the same ones, then by duality you cannot have any volume that is smaller than the Planck mass, and basically this F is associated to the volume. So F cannot be larger than Planck mass. Then they considered anisotropic compactifications also. And in that case, they were be able to find some large F, but then they were not controlling the summations. But I think they didn't go ahead behind this point. And it's an interesting question, definitely. Concerning the point whether this is a problem of string theory or field theory, however, let me also say that this assumption is an assumption that it goes a little bit beyond the field theory. Is an assumption by which you are saying, okay, gravity doesn't respect global charges. This is something that you don't, I think, is something that is not a statement that you can do just in pure field theory. In any case. Okay, so the argument, well, let's say, let me just assume as a working assumption that F cannot be larger than point mass in string theory. And then look at the data. This is the last data, the last fitting of the cosine potential from, well, Savage, Katie Fries, and Wilkini using the WMAP data. And this is 1 sigma, and this is 2 sigma contour. This is the plane of the spectral index versus the tensor to scalar ratio. And these red lines correspond to fixed values of the parameter F in units of Planck mass. So you have F equal to 2.5 here, that is clearly excluded, and 3.5 is at 2 sigma, more or less the limit. So roughly speaking, the condition is F larger than more or less 3.5 Planck masses. As F increases and decreases and increases, you get very deep in the allowed region. And actually, in this regime, this corresponds to having inflation happening just at the bottom part of the potential.
How many folds does this assume, 60?
40, 50, 60, 70. The blue lines correspond to different number of efforts.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I forgot
so
to say that.
This is for lots of efforts.
Yeah,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
This is for lots of efforts.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they have also this blue band here that corresponds to the region in which the reheating temperature is larger than 1 GeV. So, in any case, it seems to be clear that F larger than Planck mass is required for this thing. And this, well, let's assume that what I said 1 second ago was right. This is in contradiction with the requirements from string theory. Okay, so way out is, as usual, add some new field. And there are several models of inflation in string theory that appears to work, and there are actually modifications of natural inflation, in particular Rayestack inflation of Blanco-Piard and many other, was working in a two-dimensional plane where the inflaton was exactly sorry, a string theory dilaton and its imaginary component, that is the axion. So this is the cosine potential that I mentioned before, but there is also this other direction, and inflation occurs in a direction that is diagonal in this sense. And in this case, they can get enough e-folds and get reasonable results, even using F that is slightly smaller than the Planck mass. I think their F is something like Planck mass over square root of string, something like that. Another possibility, more general, was studied by Kim Niles and Peloso, and is the idea of using 2 PNGBs and having some flat direction, diagonal. So this is the direction of 1 PNGB rho. This is the other one, theta. If you fix one of the two, the cosines have a period that is smaller than Planck mass, but you can have some diagonal direction in which actually the potential is much more shallow. And what I'm going to...
Another question. How dependent on that specific cosine phi over F plus 1 form is this? I mean, if you had a whole sum of terms you had to consider, you generate all kinds of functions, I guess, of phi over F, right?
Well,
you just have to have still the shift symmetry, but...
Yes, but I think as a quite general...
Let me put it another way. I mean, you wrote down something with a 5 phi over F. Now, couldn't you generate phi over 1/5 F, and then F could be much Let's see, which way do I want to say it? Anyway, you know, by putting some scale factor in front of phi over f, I could change the value of f that comes out, and that would be some higher harmonic or something. I don't know.
I think in the end the problem is that the problem always boils down to this convergence of the series. If you are looking for a series that converges, your coefficient have to be some form of f over the cutoff of your theory, to some power. Now, unless there is a very fine tuning of f being very close to this thing, in which all the coefficients are summed in some funny way and give something different, in general, you will have that the first term dominates and all the other harmonics are subdominant just because the coefficient in front of it is much smaller. I don't know if I answered your question, actually.
Yeah, well, I maybe I have to assume a little bit more afterwards, but I mean, I don't know how tied those two coefficients are. I guess the normalization and the scale appears in normalizing the phi inside the function.
Oh, no, that's quite fixedly tied by the fact that the normalization is related to the kinetic term of your field. So this f, you see, you start with a field that is dimensionless, and there is some symmetry breaking scale, for instance, that sets the normalization of the kinetic field term of the field, exactly like in the gauge usual.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, aren't there possible numerical factors that would
decorrelate
these things in some way, you know?
No, factors of order 1, probably.
Well, I was thinking of factors of order 5. I mean, you're talking about 3.5. Okay, you know, if I could get a factor of 5 that would sort of decorrelate these things in some
sure.
The bad direction.
Typically.
You go half harmonic and the potential is steeper.
I think it's a possibility, but typically, factors of order 1 very rarely help you. But again, I am not aware of any specific theorem about the fact that F has to be smaller than Planck mass exactly.
Right.
The square root of 8 pi would do, and there are two different Planck masses.
That is true, but the Planck mass of string theorists is the other one, unfortunately.
Okay.
Well, actually, that picture that I shown before from this paper on the parameters of the F, on the constraints on the F parameter, I had to modify the picture because it was used in units of the other Planck mass. But the thing doesn't change. I mean, the argument, that's the argument. Okay, so last possibility that I'm going to mention, and then accelerate, is to use several of PNGBs. This was proposed by Dimopoulos, Kaku, et al. A couple of years ago now. It's called N-flation because it's N PNGBs, and it's basically the realization of assisted inflation with PNGBs for the people that are familiar with assisted inflation. So how does it work? Very quickly, suppose that I start with N PNGBs that have, so just the sum of their Lagrangians. And then assume, for simplicity, that all the phi, all the f, and all the lambdas are equal to each other. I called it before mu, now lambda, I apologize for it. In this case, the Lagrangian is just the sum of n copies of the same Lagrangian, so this becomes some Lagrangian, but at this point, this field phi is not canonically normalized anymore, so I have to introduce a new field phi, big phi that is canonically normalized. In terms of this field, however, now, the potential is now in the form of cosine of phi divided by square root of n times f. So f gets an enhancement effectively by a factor of square root of n. And so this quantity can be larger than the Planck mass, even if f is smaller than the Planck mass. And it seems to be a kind of a trick here. Another way of understanding it, if you want. Another way of understanding this part, we remember the problem was initially to have, for instance, eta is v second over v divided by Planck mass squared, much smaller than 1. If you have several fields, you want basically eta to be small for each of the fields. So you have some eta I, that is d2v over d phi I squared, divided by the whole potential. So the trick is just to use many fields, because each of them contributes equally to the whole potential. So the denominator becomes bigger as you add fields and fields and fields, but the numerator stays always the same one. And this is a simpler, I think, way than this one, if you want to understand how things work. Even if this way is actually pretty useful to understand quantitatively how things happen.
So there's a usual argument that if I add more fields, it just makes the theory not more non-perturbative quicker.
Sure, I will get that.
So, I mean, in some sense, if you're taking a series in F over M Planck, which is when F is larger than M Planck, it's really saying the theory is getting non-perturbative.
Yes.
So another way to analyze that would be to say, to do something like say, well, where does unitary break down? Given these N fields, if I do N field scattering, this will also bring that down. So.
Yes. Those people actually, well, Dimopoulos and friends worry a lot about it. And they have a long chapter in their paper in which they discuss radiative stability of Planck mass when you add more and more of those fields. And from that, they get the upper bound of the number of fields, and I will get there in 1 second. And that's exactly what. So, in principle, there are up to 10 to 5 of these things in string theory. I'm just copying what they write. I don't know what's the compactification and what are the cycles and stuff like that. But the kind of argument that they use is basically that in order to keep the corrections to Planck mass under control, you need n to be smaller than 200 or so. So this is how much you can get in string theory. How much do you need? Well, what they get, 200. And what they do in their analysis is to assume, as I said before, they are all equal to each other. And then what they do is to assume that all of them are much smaller than f. And this corresponds to approximating the cosine potential just with its quadratic part. And they get that n has to be of the order of 200. That is exactly what is the marginal limit that you would get from string theory, and so you are at the limit of getting detectable, and it's very, very interesting. After that, there was a paper by, God, by Liddell, and no, not, well, by Andrew Liddell, if depends on what you think about him, that had done the same analysis, assuming, however, that they are not all equal to each other, but they are equally distributed on an interval from 0 to Planck mass to start with. And they say that n has to be of the order of 600. It's actually quite easy to find the origin of this factor of 1/3. But. So things seem to get much worse. And in some sense, it could even give some problem to the model. However, things are not really so bad if you require if you drop the requirements that all the phis are much smaller than f. Indeed, this requirement corresponds to approximating that cos x is just 1 plus x squared minus x squared over 2. That corresponds to a large effective f that corresponds automatically to a large n. So in some sense, they are already putting in the large n requirement when they do this expansion. And a very preliminary computation that I did yesterday on the plane says that if you drop this requirement, well, if you assume all of them to be equal, 10 axioms is enough. If you assume that they are equally distributed on an interval from 0 to 2 pi, 50 of them is enough to have enough inflation. Basically, what you are doing is that you are exploiting the few axioms that are sitting on the top of the potential. And they are the ones that contribute the most to inflation.
Does this affect the spectrum?
That's the part that it can. I mean,
reverse engineering okay. argument. If you notice the difference between
yes
cosine and just its one term in this expansion, it sounds like you're probing
yes.
a lot of the potential, and therefore
absolutely it does
picking up possibly dramatic.
So in the case in which all of them are equal to each other, of course it doesn't change the shape of the spectrum. You're just reducing exactly to natural inflation. In that case, it's really a back of the envelope calculation because you need to have f larger than 3.5 Planck masses, and you have an enhancement of square root of n. So you just look for the n such that square root of n is 3.5. That's where I get my 10.
So are you saying they didn't? So they weren't doing something?
Everybody was assuming only to keep the quadratic potential because it's easier, and also because in any case this thing is easy to do because I'm assuming that all the parameters in all the cosines are exactly the same. If you start considering a spectrum of lambdas and of f's, it gets more complicated. I mean, the paper by Little and Kim is detailed in this direction, but is always assuming only the quadratic time. Okay. In any case, there we go. Okay, I think I've convinced you about this. So let me go to the main part of the talk. I'm sorry. So I will stick to inflation to fix ideas, but this argument holds for any model of inflation with PNGBs. The argument, the idea that we had is very, very simple. That is, PNGB are pseudoscalars. All the couplings that can happen in theory happen. So in particular, a coupling of any pseudoscalar to FF tilde, where F is the electromagnetic field, will happen. The worst case scenario is in the case in which this coupling goes as, one over Planck mass. So the best, what I will assume, and this couplings are parameterized by this dimensionless number alpha, and I will assume that alpha is 1 or so. And then I will discuss actually what I need to be alpha. And now, at this point, during inflation, this phi I is rolling, so it's evolving with time. So it's a source for FF tilde. When you try to quantize a field on the top of a non-trivial potential, you amplify vacuum fluctuations of the field, and so you expect to produce electric and, in particular, magnetic fields from this mechanism. And this was our starting point. So why should we care about magnetic fields? Well, first of all, because they exist. They have been observed with a number of techniques. If you try to read the literature, at least I tried to read the literature, and I found many, many contradictory statements. Something that seems to be quite consistent is that there is solid evidence in the galaxy to have magnetic fields in the order of the microgauss. In clusters, there is some evidence to have, again, magnetic fields in the order of the microgauss. At larger scales, at least, I could find whatever in the literature. And let me mention, however, an interesting point that is a magnetic field of the order of the microgauss is actually a very strong one. Its energy corresponds to the energy in the CMB. It's the same order of magnitude. And it happens actually that this magnetic field is at equipartition with the energy in ionized plasmas in the galaxy. So that actually you have more or less same energy in magnetic field and in plasma. And the interesting thing of this field is that nobody knows where these guys come from. So the main question is whether they are primordial, and this is very difficult to realize. It's very difficult to have a model of primordial magnetic fields, and also they cannot be really entirely primordial because, again, they would be at equipartition with the CMB, and we would see them in the CMB, for instance, with effects on B modes, as far as I understand. They could also have been produced at astrophysical mechanisms, and this can be used to explain in particular the smaller fields. And there is a mechanism that, well, nobody agrees again on the fact that this mechanism actually works, but there is kind of agreement on it, that is called the dynamo mechanism to produce these magnetic fields at smaller scales. So how does it work? Well, this is the main equation that describes the evolution of a magnetic field in a plasma with some velocity in the plasma and some conductivity. And the regime in which, main property, of course, of this equation is that it's linear in B. So this means if you start with B equal to 0, you stay with B equal to 0. However, in particular, if you have large conductivity and you start with a small B, basically, using the differential rotation of the plasma inside the galaxy while the galaxy collapses, the magnetic field can be amplified. And the question is, of course, that you have a seed field to start with in order to get the observed magnetic field. And the question is, how large a seed field is required? And well, the point is, basically, that the intensity of the magnetic field doubles every time that the galaxy does a rotation. So you have an exponential amplification of the magnetic field. And this leads really into exponential uncertainties. And again, I just take two cases that I find in the literature. Somebody, Giovannini, that claims that the best case scenario is 10 to minus 23 Gauss at 1 megaparsec to start with, before the galaxy forms.
So best meaning
his best case scenario is this one. Best in the sense of easier, the smallest unit. There is other people like Ann Davis that claim that 10 to minus 30 Gauss at a smaller scale of 10 kiloparsec is already enough. And in any case, the interesting thing is that when you look at the literature, even producing 10 to minus 30 Gauss at 10 kiloparsec is very difficult. And so, just
has to be a sort of unidirectional thing. I mean, what if it were, each galaxy started out with a seed in a different direction, would that screw everything up?
That are all open questions. People don't know, even observationally, it's not clear. You need I think the direction doesn't really matter, because the galaxy is the rotation of the galaxy that does the main thing. But you need to have an initial, unless probably there is, there will be some degenerate direction in which. But usually the procedure is just take a field and then take a small fluctuation over the top of it and see that this thing explodes.
But this has to at least be uniform across the galaxy where it's seen.
Absolutely. You need to have some coherence length to start with.
So if you start with a small seed in one little location,
not enough.
So it has to be a big correlated fluctuation on
at
the galaxy
least of,
scale.
At least of the order of this power at this length, at least.
So that means
that's the galaxy scale, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah, you cannot.
And then if the PNGB is going to amplify this, that also has to be correlated over the whole galaxy. Is that right?
Well, the PNGB is going to. I will get there. The PNGB is going to generate a thing that is. Well, it's correlated at small scales, but it spreads out enough to generate this kind of thing.
Do you trust any of these?
Sorry?
And you know why I'm asking.
Given
that they go all over the board.
No.
Right? I mean, and also there are other people that made these estimates, and they also go.
Yeah.
They extend the board even further.
No. I mean, I'm taking this as a benchmark. There has to be something. Again, as I said, it's not even sure. There is people that that say that the whole dynamo mechanism doesn't work at all. It's a dirty field. I have to say when I think that we are in the epoch of precision cosmology, and then I look at those things, I go back.
But, just as a sort of simple issue of curiosity, in your view, since you've looked at the details, which of these claims, descriptions, or whatever, have you personally found most compelling?
I didn't find anything that was... Let me say this. Unfortunately, most of those people is people that do models and do analysis of data. And usually they analyze the data in such a way that it supports their models. So Giovannini has a model that is pre-Big Bang, in which he claims that it can produce very strong magnetic fields. So he has the interest of saying that you need very strong magnetic fields. Other people that don't believe in pre-Big Bang are much more, they are ready to give up much more. This uncertainty comes from an uncertainty in an exponent. Basically, it's well known how this magnetic fields go up. It goes up as e to the gamma t, and this gamma, there is an uncertainty of factor of 2 in this gamma that is related to how galaxies rotate and stuff like that.
And
so
this is what some kind of hydrodynamic instability and blah 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 that they simply don't know how to calculate.
Yes. And people don't know what's there. The problem is that people don't know what's out there. I mean, even all these measurements of this magnetic field, they never measure directly the magnetic field. They measure always the magnetic field times the density of electrons.
Yeah.
And you need to have an independent measurement of number of electrons.
So You said people claim that dynamo mechanism doesn't work at all, but I thought the dynamo mechanism was possible with things like the Earth's magnetic field. And there should be small scale Earth based experiments that do use the dynamo mechanism. I know one in particular.
No. I mean, they are not saying that the dynamo mechanism doesn't work at all. It's the dynamo mechanism in galaxies. Because you need some conditions to be fulfilled, you know, in terms of conductivity, viscosity.
At least in the case of Earth, you know what's pretty supporting. It's the molten iron in the core.
Well, yeah, you have an idea what's in the Earth. The point is that apparently people don't have a really clear... I mean, apart from our galaxy, in which there is established evidence, there is maps of the magnetic fields, how they go... The inversions they have, but everything that's outside of the galaxy, you can get easily factors of 10 of difference on the same thing. In any case,
don't worry so much about the time.
If you starve, it's not my my interest either. In any case, just because I want to be nice to myself, I will assume this case. Best case scenario, but I will discuss also the worst case scenario. So let's go back to our model. This is the point. So in order to simplify the analysis, I will follow exactly what Dimopoulos et al. Did, that is to assume that all the PNGBs have the same value. But notice that in this case also the sign of the PNGBs matter. Before, I had just a cosine potential that is even and the kinetic term that is even. Now I have the sum of this phi I. And, you know, I can think of the extreme case in which for each phi I that goes right, there is one that goes left, and the effect cancels exactly. So I have to care also about the overall sign of the direction in which these guys are rolling. Basically, I will have n magnetic fields, n PNGBs. I'm assuming that all of them have the same absolute value, but I will have... let's say n plus of them on this side and then minus of them on this side. They will go down.
Do they all have the same potential?
No.
So that's why you don't do the orthogonal rotation in the absolute space. Because you could, in principle, just the kinetic terms are certainly invariant under O(n).
Yes, they don't have all the same potentials.
Not even in the quadratic approximation?
They have different masses. There is a paper by Easter and other people that started the spectrum of masses that you expect to get from this for these models. And it's a spectrum of masses.
Because, you know, since this is a linear term, you can just rotate in the phi space to direct the coupling along one.
Yes. Well, this amounts to a rotation. I mean, also this alpha is actually a vector in principle.
Of course.
But in the end, it's all coefficients of order one that come here and there. As long as the potentials are the same ones. But yes. In any case, okay. So I define this parameter gamma, that is the number of the ones that go right minus the number of the ones that go left. And divided by the total number. So gamma is between minus 1 and 1. This is my master equation. Now, F plus and minus are the positive and negative elicity modes of the magnetic field. In co-moving. And so this is basically B1 plus IB2 and B1 minus IB2 if you direct the z-axis, well, the axis along z. And these are the equations. And you see, as long as I neglect this term, this is just a simple equation of motion of a massless particle, as it has to be. But then you have this source here. And the main property of this source is that it comes with opposite sign for the two elicity modes. This means that you have an effective mass term that is time-dependent for both of the modes, and for one of the modes is tachyonic. So what you expect is to have an exponential amplification of one of the two elicity modes, the one that corresponds to the tachyonic mode. And, one technical detail, one nice thing is that you can write down basically the equation of motion for the inflaton just in terms, of the PNGBs just in terms of slow roll parameters, so epsilon. And all the results will depend only on this combination that they call psi of the parameters of the theory. So I remind you, this is alpha is the couplings of the PNGBs to the electromagnetic field. Gamma is this total of right moving minus left moving axions. N is the number of axions. And this is our result. So you have some factor here that you care a little bit, but not too much. And the main thing, as I said, is that one of the two modes, the one that corresponds to a tachyonic mass, gets exponentially amplified. So it's amplified by a factor of e to the pi xi during inflation. So even if xi is not a huge number, you know, xi of the order of 10 or so, immediately you have a huge magnetic field. And we were very happy when
where
we found
it. The amplitude of the initial fluctuation encoded?
It's here. Is this square? It's just a square root of k over 2.
That I don't. Could you go back to your differential equation?
Sure.
This is homogeneous, so don't you? I mean, it's homogeneous.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah.
So you have to put in a k is independent of the starting magnitude of f, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So that's what. Is there
just the quantum fluctuation
coefficient in front of that? Mm-hmm.
Yes,
okay.
But it's the normalization that comes from fluctuations of the vacuum.
So this is just the usual uncertainty
Bogoliubov
principle.
Yes.
Normal ordering
yes.
of the
yes.
0 point fluctuation.
Absolutely.
I see. So what does that mean? So the magnitude of f that you start with is
it's just the uncertainty relation, basically. If you want, that's
the ground state.
It's the ground state of the quantum mechanical system.
Just like with
so in these natural units, what is that? I'm just trying to.
Well, the point is, what are the units of this thing?
So you said h bar equal to 1, basically.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So we're talking about half h bar or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Exactly. The reason that inflation doesn't do that for you without normal is that you wouldn't have that d phi by d tau term.
Yeah.
Gravity itself that likes to produce all kinds of particles does not like to produce the ones that are conformally invariant in FRW universes because it's conformally Minkowski. So you go to conformal frame where the thing just moves in Minkowski space and there is no stability to squeeze it, to amplify it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why you need always a coupling to something else
to
that
something
breaks conformance in effect. The procedure is exactly the same one that you use when you do cosmological perturbations. You always assume that the system starts in its adiabatic vacuum in the
way.
No, that's okay. And so that's the exponential amplification term. And so from that, one can in particular find that, the energy density in magnetic modes is just k cubed times f squared with this choice of normalization, where f squared is just b squared. And so this is the energy density in magnetic modes during inflation. It's the Hubble parameter during inflation. It has a very blue spectrum to the power 4.5 and this large normalization. So power is concentrated actually in short wavelength modes. If you have that this is the Hubble parameter, you will have power that goes like this, more or less. This is a Hubble radius. So you have lots of power at scales that are slightly below the Hubble radius up to coefficients of order 1 and go to 0 very quickly outside. And that's the reason why one has before starting to say, okay, I get a big psi and immediately I get a large magnetic field, one has to worry about another problem, that is the problem of back reaction of the energy of this stuff on the background. In this analysis, what I've done is to assume that the magnetic field is a perturbation, and I'm neglecting the fact that the magnetic field itself carries an energy and affects the Hubble equations and also is coupled to the inflaton, so it can change the evolution of the inflaton. Now, when the energy in the magnetic field becomes comparable with the background energy, you start having troubles. At least the approximation breaks down. When does it happen? Well, if you insist on H to be of the order of 10 to 13 GeV, and so you insist on Kobe normalization, this parameter psi has to be smaller than 7. That's quite strong. If you assume H that is 10 to minus larger than 10 to minus 3 electron volts, that is the most generous assumption. In any case, this parameter psi has to be smaller than 25. So even before we go to the positive part of saying, okay,
really
we can produce magnetic
field.
Sorry?
You really have that much freedom in H?
Well, if you believe there are these curvatron mechanisms by which you can lower a little bit the scale of inflation, and basically the value of H is fixed by Kolbe normalization once a model is given.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a curvatron, you can have that the inflaton does something and the curvaton fixes Kolbe normalization.
Mm-hmm.
So the inflaton can go. H 10 to minus 3 electron volts corresponds to an inflationary scale of 1 TeV.
Mm-hmm.
A row of 1 TeV, and it's. I mean, strictly speaking, if you look at curvatron literature, they have a hard time at going with H below KeVs.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think that it's just a limitation from fantasy of people for the time being. Because they are just adding more and more ways of getting cosmological perturbations that are.
What you're saying is if you just look at the numbers and not worry about theoretical prejudice for model building, then you are in this regime.
Absolutely. If, and that's the point, if I violate this regime, this means that the model, there's something to say about the model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's take the extreme case that I have my string theorist that says, okay, I have my model of inflation string theory, it's a PNGB, the coupling of the PNGB to the electromagnetic field is such and such. If this condition is realized, then the analysis of the inflation has to take into account the PNGB. I don't know what happens because everything becomes nonlinear, but something will happen. And sorry. And also, this is in the case in which I'm considering just one electromagnetic field. But if you believe in string theory, there are zillions of U1s all over the place. And in principle, each of these U1s can be excited. So each of them has its own energy, and it contributes to this bound. So that this bound can be actually much more stringent. Okay. Now, some parts of this analysis were done by Garretson, Field, and Carroll in 92. They were the first that did some detailed analysis of PNGB and production of magnetic fields. And this was their conclusion. That if we, they found similar constraints. Basically, they just found that actually the spectrum was very blue. And they said, okay, if the spectrum is very blue, I cannot at the same time have a lot of energy, well, not have too much energy here so that I can neglect back reaction, and have a large magnetic field here where I want to have large magnetic fields to satisfy, to be in agreement with observations. So, what they say was that if we obey the constraints that I've just shown, psi smaller than 7, and if there is no evolution of magnetic field after inflation apart from trivial stretching, then the magnetic field today is too weak to be the one that you observe. And basically, based on this paper, people have stopped looking about magnetic fields produced by PNGB inflation forever.
Mm-hmm.
You go to every review, and you have usually a line in which they say, oh, there's this very nice possibility, but these people show that it doesn't work.
For instance, this blue shift, this blue spectrum, that's really the spectrum that you are producing vector perturbations. So
yes, absolutely, absolutely. However, the point is that this assumption is not true. And that's my second main point. The point is that, I will really just keep to the main points now. The point is just that the field that we have produced has maximal elicity. Because the background is maximally violating parity. The PNGB is a pseudoscalar. So, and what happens is that during, if you have large conductivity, the helicity is conserved. So you have this very blue field. At small scales, magneto-hydrodynamical effects, basically dissipation, wants to suppress power here, just by causal phenomena. But now you have to conserve this quantity, because this now is a conserved number. So you have to transfer this power somewhere. So it goes to larger scale and larger. And that's a phenomenon that is known as inverse cascade. And, well, for instance, these are results of numerical simulations, and there are other papers in which there are similar results. So they start with the solid line. This is K. This is intensity of the field. So this corresponds to large scales, that is small scales. This is without ellipticity. They start with the solid line, and then basically dissipation dumps power at small scales, and nothing happens at large scales. When they put ellipticity in the game, dissipation again dumps power at small scales, but the power has to go somewhere, so it moves to larger scales. And what is even nicer is that there is this self-similarity property of the spectrum by which the scalar index...
And it's all causal because all happens in subparameter scales. But that little...
Yeah.
That suppression at low scales essentially tilts up the curve before it leaves the horizon, and then it increases still blue, but with a different amplitude.
Well, these are simulations that are in non-expanding universe. They are related by trivial conformal transformations to the ones. But, yes.
But the bottom line is you don't have to worry about any causal super...
No, nothing. Actually, well, this is the scalings that are more or less found. This 2 over 3 is not always a 2 over 3. Sometimes it's a little bit more, sometimes it's a little bit less because it's numerics. But that's more or less the scaling. And in particular, the scale spectral index stays constant. And this is our result after we take into account everything, and in particular what you were mentioning. So we start with scales that are super horizon, so nothing happens until the scale becomes smaller than the horizon, and then I start applying these scaling rules. And so I get 10 to minus 33 e to the pi psi Gauss. So that if I want to satisfy the condition of 10 to minus 30 Gauss, psi equal to 2 is enough. If I want to saturate the condition that was psi larger than 7, I can get, at psi equal to 7, I get something like 10 to minus 25 Gauss at 10 kiloparsec. If I want to go and saturate psi equal to 25, that was the extreme, most optimistic case of a very low scale inflation, the magnetic field can be as large as I want, basically, like 10 to minus 6 Gauss at 1 megaparsec.
So, is there reheating temperature added to that formula?
Yes, well, because the...
What do you want to avoid? Gravitino problem?
No. Because the scaling goes... goes as a function of the conformal time. The conformal time is related to the time, but also to the way the expansion, the universe expands. So depending on whether the universe is matter-dominated or radiation-dominated, the scaling is actually different. Mm-hmm. So that's where, since before heating, the universe is assumed to be matter-dominated, you have this dependence on reheating temperature. Okay, numbers. In terms of the original parameters, this is the condition that I need to satisfy, more or less. And so either for alpha of the order of phi or for gamma square root of n of the order of phi, I get enough magnetic fields. So quick discussion. First obvious possibility is phi axions and alpha equal to 10. It's not a huge fine tuning. And you get already the magnetic fields that you want to have. How can I get alpha equal to 10? Well, first of all, just comes out of number. Second possibility is... I don't have time. Just let me mention, this is much more speculative, but still, I think it's fun. Let us insist on alpha equal to 1. In this case, you need to have very large n. Gamma square root of n has to be of the order of 10. So, for instance, if you take 600, that was the indication of Lidl and Kim, you need more or less 400 that are rolling in one sense and 200 that are rolling in the other sense. If the potential is exactly symmetric for each of these axioms, this is actually extremely improbable to happen, because basically the variance is square root of n. However, just to finish with speculative statements, an asymmetry can exist. For instance, in this paper, the racetrack inflation model, actually the potential for the TNGB was kind of more complicated, going back to your point, actually. Mm-hmm. And they were considering... it has this kind of shape. And in this case, of course, inflating from here and inflating from here can be a little bit different because, well, at that point you are starting to compute probabilities in the landscape and stuff like that. And you are getting, well, as I say, very speculative, but still an asymmetry can exist at that level. So to conclude, okay, just one thing, work starting to do is to study the effect of the perturbations in the PNGB. And the reason is that the perturbations in the PNGB have a flat spectrum, while the magnetic field has a very blue spectrum. And it's possible that the interplay of these two effects can raise a little bit the spectrum of the magnetic field perturbation. That, of course, helps. And I apologize for getting so much over time.
I'll ask one numerical. Oh, sorry. I'll ask one numerical question, and this is related to something you know well. Mr. Marotto, if you make an assumption that you have 10 to the minus 30 Gauss, that is enough for the seed at a kilopascal, wouldn't that be good for him to? Some version of his paper, anyway.
I think it might be.
Right? And then in that case, what is that? I should just explain. Basically, the point is that cosmological scalar perturbations, delta rho over rho itself, produces curvature perturbation of the metric which breaks conformal symmetry. So you can, in principle, imagine, quote-unquote, rescattering the gauge field, classical gauge field, against the dimples in the cosmological background themselves, and that will then produce essential terms in the equation that are very similar to the ones Lorenzo considered. And then the question is just how efficient that whole process is. And I do seem to...
I have to recheck on those things.
Okay. In that case, actually, perhaps that would be very favorable to your point three.
Yeah. No, definitely.
But then also you might argue maybe you don't need the...
I'm not sure. I remember Marotto saying himself that he had problems with dissipation. Mm. That for me is a help because I have this property of elicity that he doesn't have. Still, I have to check.
When you say perturbations in the equation, which equation?
Delta rho, the scale, the fluctuations that produce galaxies themselves. Curve everything up in space. That's how they make galaxies. But in turn, it turns, they could also squeeze a little bit of the magnetic field.
Through his modifications in his G-squared.
Exactly,
F.
The same type of equation.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I
was
Okay.
So, this was beautiful talk. It matches on to this ugly, ugly stuff, which is the dynamo and all the stuff that nobody understands, nobody understands. What's the future of this field? So, ideally, someone writes a paper and everyone says, yeah, that's finally, we understand magnetic fields. But it's not going to happen until the other end cooperates.
I agree. Let me say this. That if, I mean, we are among friends.
Turn it off.